Well, thank you to the WIPO for the invitation. I noticed on the docket for today, I am the only economist. I take it that you know the implicit economics rule that the quality of the party varies inversely with the number of economists that you invite. There's a very good reason for that. Economists are known to overlap, or indeed sometimes smother, discussion with facts, empirical analyses, and mathematical models. That's sometimes a bad thing, but I would argue in this case it's a very good thing. So what I'm going to try to do for you is to summarize in as few minutes as possible roughly 200 papers by economists that have analyzed exactly what you're talking about. So the good news is I'm going to summarize really quickly. The even better news is if you don't have a copy of my slides, they've been printed and they're available as a separate handout just outside. Even better than that, the actual white papers that go through the entire literature review, complete with all the references, are coming out and will be on this website shortly. So thanks to WIPO for making this talk possible. Thanks to the U.S. National Chamber of Commerce and the National Peace Foundation for supporting the work itself. I'm going to boil it down to three things. There's a big story at play here, and if another economist is in the room, they know exactly what that story is. It's interesting that it hasn't been mentioned yet. Number two, I'm going to tell you what economists already know. We know a lot, and it's surprising that a lot of it has come out today in the form of questions. I wonder if we could study, we could study that. In fact, we know that answer, and I could tell you where to find it if you'd like it. There's also, of course, an infinite universe of things that economists and you would like to know, so I'd encourage this to be the start of a conversation. Come get my business card or email me and let me know what we should find out together. There's an active community of economists who want to figure this out. So get us started in the right direction. You have the questions, we have the tools. Let's have a cocktail party. Uncertainty is the story. For an economist, uncertainty is the story, the whole story, and nothing but the story. That is the fundamental problem, the challenge within the innovation activity. If innovation were dead certain, you knew you threw $10 in and you get $12 out, everyone would do it. It'd be simple. The problem is you're not sure. And the problem, it's reviewed in other people, the problem is ever so much greater for green technology, for eco innovation. The problem is, okay, the research problems are enormous, they're complex, there's uncertainty surrounding competing products, but that's true of all other products as well. The real uncertainty for eco-innovation is valuation by the marketplace is horrendously uncertain. People don't know how to evaluate what you just developed for them. Great, you've got a wind turbine. What does that do for me exactly? I know it does something to my electricity bill, but I'm not exactly sure what the price of electricity is going to be next year, whether there's going to be a government rebate in place. And what does that do in terms of the externalities, the impacts on my neighbor of the fossil fuels I'm not using? Most people, including economists, have a real tough time valuing eco-innovation. Uncertainty, especially of this horrendously large type, reduces investment. There is no doubt about that. I could cite you hundreds of studies that show that. All the way back from Bernoulli and the St. Petersburg paradox, can have a good talk about gambling over coffee hour if you want, going to studies of R&D managers, mentioned just a moment ago, to game show contestants, I've done some of those myself. The whole reason behind insurance markets is that uncertainty is a bad thing. People want to avoid it. They pay to avoid it. So the conclusion has to be reducing risk has a value. There's obviously a role for patents here because property rights reduce risk. They don't eliminate it, but they reduce them. But then aren't patents inefficient? I mean, they're being anti-competitive, right? Might we achieve a better result if we had weaker patent law, we had compulsory licensing? An economist would say, you're finding a static solution to a dynamic problem. This is equivalent to the story of the hen who lays the golden eggs. If you hinder or even kill the hen, You get today's eggs a whole lot easier because, boy, you can harvest them without any clucking and biting. The problem, of course, is if you want that stream of eggs to continue beyond today, you have to think very carefully about how you nurture those egg layers. So maybe less developed countries could just wait for others to innovate and just borrow what comes on, right? Well, there are a huge number of questions that follow on from that. I would say the last one is the most provocative. Why couldn't emerging economies and less developed countries be the leaders instead of waiting to be followers? Yeah, I know there are a couple of answers to that. Let's talk about them. All right, can less developed countries adopt existing technology? There is a study out this year, Copenhagen Group, found that IPRs do not constitute, I'm quoting them almost exactly, as significant a barrier to LDC adoption of emission reduction technologies as has been previously supposed. The evidence is, if you look internationally at IPR-protected technologies and open-source kind of technologies, the price is roughly the same in a wide variety of eco-innovative industries. So I think the real question then is, should IPRs, patents specifically, be tailored to fit eco-innovation? Numerous studies have suggested, well, this is kind of the way to go. It's ludicrous to suggest that all industries behave similarly, so all industries should have exactly the same protection. The problem, of course, is, well, who draws the line? How do we draw the line? How do we evaluate without getting into really messy logistics, administratives? But there's an enormous list of studies. Honestly, we already treat some sectors differently. The real question, I think, is how should we consider eco-innovation separate and distinct from other forms? I'd suggest seven reasons, seven ways in which eco-innovation is different. Number one, and the big one, is externalities. This is the big hidden word that nobody said today. For economists, it's all about the externalities. Well, okay, and the uncertainty too, but they're wrapped up. The externalities are the effects on people other than the buyer and the seller of the product. So if I buy a wind turbine for my backyard, my neighbor is better off because I'm not using carbon-laden fuel sources, and therefore I'm not contributing to global warming, environmental pollutions, all those sorts of things. He has no say in whether I buy the wind turbine or not, and so we have no way of communicating the benefit that he's receiving from my choice of consumption. The problem, of course, is that if there is an externality problem, it's proven time and again. Theory says it's true, and empirics show it to be true. We invest too little. We buy too little. We don't innovate enough. And let's face it, a vision without resources is merely a hallucination. So what could we do? An economist would say, well, let's fix the markets. The problem is not about the property rights themselves. The problem is about the markets that don't appropriately value environmental goods. Why don't we have markets for tradable permits and emissions? Okay, we've started that. Why don't we have futures or derivatives markets based on those so that you and I could make projections, bid and sell, create incentives to innovate for others in the future? So the financing challenge is, if we let the markets drive the story, we won't get enough innovation. Simple as that. We could just subsidize research. We could throw public money at the problem, right? Well, there have been a number of studies this saying, wow, that's a terrifically horrible idea. Holland, Van Rien, and I say have the authoritative study. They say if you put a dollar in, if you wait long enough, you get a dollar out. And I don't know about you, but that's not the way I would run my research shop. Number two, second reason. A lot of eco-innovation is basic or fundamental research. For basic and fundamental research, presumably we want open access to follow-on innovators. We want it published in the sense of a patent document that you saw earlier, but we also want open access for follow-on or incremental improvements, localization improvements. There is really strong proof down here at the bottom. Okay, a lot of it is mine, but it's still proof. It's all in peer-reviewed journals, so somebody's looked through my numbers and checked to make sure that they're right, that distance matters less and less. Between innovators or between one generation of innovator and the next. It matters less and less where you live. What's important is simply access to the information. If you have access to patent documents, you too could innovate in this field, given the appropriate scientific and engineering know-how. You no longer have to live in Boston, for example. Local adaptation, reason number three, local adaptations are usually required. Usually, you have to do something to fix it to the environment. Okay, some things work pretty much equally well wherever you go. Solar panels, wind turbines. But is eco-innovation globally transferable? In other words, if you just wait for someone else to innovate it, will you be able to use the same thing in your backyard that they innovated for theirs? I did a study back in 2000 with Bob Evanson of Yale, where we looked at agricultural use patents in particular. We looked at all ag use patents that were developed in the US, Europe, and Japan over a 30-year period and asked, where are these protected among 90 less developed countries in the world across 30 years? And we asked, are those locations where they are protected somehow identifiable by similar soil types, similar climate types, similar education types? The answer is, well, yeah, all those things matter, but far and away the most important thing is market size. You protect your innovations where the markets are. Why is there underinvestment in a malaria vaccine? You know that answer. Reason number four, economies of scale. There is really clear evidence, as cited here by about 8 or 9 papers, that there are lower costs per unit, if you develop in bulk, if you produce in scale. There's a classic example, the First Solar. If you don't know that case, I'd encourage you to read Thomas Friedman's Hot, Flat, and Crowded. It's a great story about a company that picked up and moved from Ohio to the eastern part of Germany for precisely this reason. I'm going to skip this page just because I'm trying to keep on a deadline. Reason number five, there is induced innovation for eco-innovation. Induced innovation simply means if the price of one input of production rises, you would expect people to react by trying to avoid that higher price. I mean, wouldn't you? When you see the price of labor rise, you try to think of ways you can use fewer labor hours in your factory. If the price of electricity rises, dot, dot, dot. There are great studies, lots of them. I'll give you one that's, well, least great of the list, but the one I'm most familiar with. It's coming out in the Energy Journal in January. We looked at how the prices of gasoline, price of oil more generally, impacted the number of innovations in fuel-efficient automobile technologies. And we controlled for the impact of policy, corporate average fuel efficiency standards, for example. They're important, but the real story is in prices. If you can impact the price of oil, you can drive companies to find a way to innovate. These are the specific empirical results that we find in the study using about 30 years worth of daily data. They're huge. Number six, reason number six, I'm almost done. Sensitivity to policy. Eco-innovation is enormously sensitive to policy changes. Well, think about the price of oil, for example. If you slap on a little tax on gasoline or petrol at the pump, think of what that does to the incentive for people to use less. And that's something that's inelastically demanded. Think about how you could impact other things like plastic bags. The rest of the world is way ahead of the US on that, incidentally. There is great evidence that the details of policy matter way more than the overarching rubric. It's not, well, shall we go with rebates or shall we go with subsidies? And that's important, but what's more important is how should we give the rebate back to consumers? Should it be 5.5 cents to ratchet up to 6.5 cents, or should we just nail it at 6 and leave it there? The details matter so much more than the big picture. That's the overarching result that I can draw you to out of those about 12 or 15 studies. Oh, and in fact, one last thing, the one down at the bottom, there's an interesting study that shows perception of policy stringency is actually more important than the policy details themselves. Firms that perceive they're in a very environmentally friendly, socially conscious, strict policy environment actually behave as if they were there, even when they're not. It's a cool result. Final on my list. I'm sure you could add more. Number 7, system complexity. Eco-innovation is extremely complicated, not necessarily more so than all other technologies, but it's really complicated because of the way we try to model environmental impacts, the way they interact with each other, and then how they impact economic agents, producers and consumers. The simplest model, Nordhaus 94, has 74 variables and 32 equations. That's the simplest model, and it gets substantially more complicated from there. It doesn't mean it can't be done, but it does mean it takes some time. So it'd be wise for us to get started. All right, so my conclusions. Non-economists would probably say there's an ethical, there's a moral, there's an overriding social principle at work here. There's a reason to treat eco-innovation separately. I'm not arguing that. You can argue that all you want, but I'm not a non-economist. I'm an economist, and there's an economics reason to treat eco-innovation separately, distinctly. Eco-innovation runs into some challenges that are either distinct or more acute for it than for other forms of innovation. If I haven't convinced you in my speed race through the topics, then I hope reading the white papers will convince you of that. If that doesn't convince you, then email me. The Coase theorem could work well here. I don't know if you know the Coase theorem. Coase theorem is the idea that externalities should resolve themselves as long as two conditions are present. Number one, the costs of negotiation are low. People can talk to each other. Hey, you know, you're polluting my backyard. Let's figure out a solution here. And number two, huge important number two, property rights are clear. Who owns the right to the air? Who owns the right to pollute or to have clean air? Who owns the right to buy or sell a particular piece of technology? They have to be abundantly clear so that negotiations can start. Otherwise, we're just all arguing in a vacuum. Economists, I would argue, should start focusing on these problems. They may already have done so, but I can't find them. I would argue some of these are really important for us to start tackling right now. And by us, I am self-impugning. I have not been tackling these issues the way that I should be. So let's talk. Thank you for inviting me to this cocktail party. I hope it's the first of many.